And welcome back to Success Made to Last. I'm Rick Tokini. This is our Legend Show, and our very special guest today is Ray Lane. And I want to thank up front our mutual friend, Philippe Buissou, who introduced the two of us. And Ray has a legendary career, and I want to be talking to him today about all the great accomplishments that he's had along the way. But Ray, when I look at this wonderful bio of yours, what stands out to me is just pure leadership, a person who I think is a futurist who was able to look beyond your companies and be about team building and focus on growth. But then I also see the story of a man and his wife who are deeply committed to giving up of their time and their money to what matters to them, including the American Cancer Society and all the other accolades that you've received in your career. It is a pleasure and honor to have you on Legends today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really good to be with you.
So I would love for you to provide us some of the highlights of your career from your perspective and maybe tell our listening audience some things that they haven't heard before about what you think makes up a great career relative to your experiences.
Well, as you imagine, I get this question a lot. I think it just means that you're getting old enough that people can look back on enough years and ask you how you got to where you got to. And it's not an easy story to look back and say, okay, well, it was a series of fortunate events, luck and accidents, and hopefully there's some performance thrown in there that we did the right things and made the right decisions. So I guess, given that I've been asked this question a lot, I kind of always answer it and say, if I have to answer it in one phrase, it is, when I come back to my hometown, Pittsburgh — I still live in California — I meet people that I went to school with, high school and college with, and they look at me and say, you know, geez, it's amazing what you've achieved, but you haven't changed. You are the same person I knew back in the 60s. And that, to me, is the biggest compliment anyone could pay me, is that that any, you know, success, whether that means that you are entitled or run big companies or you have some wealth, it doesn't change the way you treat people and the way you interact with people and the way you join teams and be part of a community. And so that's the short answer to my question. Now, obviously, some of the highlights where I was very fortunate to have a search firm find me. I didn't think so at the time, because I was really happy at Booz Allen and Hamilton as a senior partner and running a very large practice there. And I thought that was going to be it. I would stay with Booz Allen and enjoy the ride that I was on at the time. And a search firm interrupted all that by asking me if I would come to Oracle as president and COO. And Oracle was, in 1991 and 1992, in big trouble. It had run out of cash. It had hit the wall. It was declining in sales. It had real issues with customers. And the job was really to turn it around, get credibility back with the customers, develop new products that were competitive in the marketplace, get the team on one page in terms of operating worldwide. And we were very successful in making that happen. And in 2000, I had a 2-year-old and a new baby on the way, and I was 51 years old and decided that I wanted a life that where I could stay home. I wanted to be, you know, still active, an important part of Silicon Valley. And so I wanted to stay in the game. But I just had a long, long career of traveling and missed mm-hmm. a lot of the my first group of kids growing up, because I was traveling with Booz Allen and with Oracle, and I found a home in venture capital and joined Kleiner Perkins. So there certainly are a number of long stakes in the tent, as you know, being president of Oracle was certainly one of them, being chairman of HP, being chairman of Carnegie Mellon, the board of Carnegie Mellon for 6 years was a huge payback to me in terms of gratification and really trying to understand something very new and in an industry that's undergoing massive change right now, higher education. So I'll try not to be long-winded in answering your questions, but that's my answer.
Thank you for that. A couple of notes inside that bio are your realization at some point in your life that family meant more to you than climbing another ladder. And so what advice would you give to our listening audience that is consumed in their career and they don't even see the fact that lives are moving fast and kids are growing up far too quickly and that they may be missing a window of time that is priceless?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'm asked this question, especially by my sons-in-law. I have three daughters that are married and I have all their friends. And I'm not sure I know how to answer it to a different generation. In my generation, it was always thought and my father, who had a extreme work ethic, he would work all day as an engineer and go to school all night. And so we'd see him for dinner. He'd stay up. He went to Carnegie Mellon and Carnegie Tech in those days, and he'd spend half the night studying to try and get his full engineering degree. And I just saw I grew up watching a work ethic and saying, is there any other way? I just didn't know there was another way. So when I came out of college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I went to college to be an engineer. I ended up being a math major. Came out, what does a math major do? Really, you go on to get a master's degree. You maybe teach, or you are a problem solver or something like that. And in 1968, at the height of the Vietnam War, graduates of college did one thing. They get drafted and they go into the service. And so I looked at various things of, could I defer it by going to graduate school? And where would that lead me? I looked at careers with General Electric, IBM, the CIA, Lincoln Insurance, just different thing that a technical degree with also some leadership characteristics. I was fortunate. When I went to college, I was kind of a shy introvert. I was certainly a good student, top 10% of my class, but I was kind of a, you look at the sea of faces and I didn't stick out. Okay. I wasn't the first to be picked on an athletic team. I was, kind of second to join the National Honor Society, the Key Club. And I was never really. And then in my sophomore year in college, my fraternity, which I joined, which was a mess at the time, elected me president. And I didn't know what to do with it. I could not answer the question, why me? And so I started taking on the job I thought of being president incurred. And that turned out to be to try and set some rules in the House, get people to, sophomores, 19-year-olds, to pay their bills, to not do so much damage on a Saturday night and try to grow the place because we couldn't pay our bills. And we grew from 30 brothers to 130 and very successful. And in fact, Saturday night here in Pittsburgh, I'll have probably 10 of my brothers over here to the house. And we do that every year. Aww. There's 10 or 15 of us that stay in very close contact from those days and remember them. I've never seen those days duplicated in other kind of other decades. And so as I offer advice to young people about family versus work, I said, well, look, the way I looked at it is I thought there was a price to be paid. So there were certainly plenty of people who I worked alongside of who would knock off at 5 o'clock and would go because they were a coach on their son's baseball team. And I always kind of thought, oh, wow, okay, so I'm not sure I understand that. I'm not sure I understand, you know, I was basically going to stay here until I dropped and somebody said, okay, you're promoted to the next thing. Whether it was IBM or it was EDS or it was Booz Allen, you know, I would just do anything I could. And my wife and I had that agreement that, you know, she was, again, this was the 60s, that, you know, she worked for a couple of years, but she wanted to be the homemaker. She wanted to raise the girls, the three girls, and I would go out and work. And I, you know, I don't know. I think it worked for me. I'm not sure it works for everybody. I don't know how it works in the millennial generation. I think they look at the world very, very differently. I think they're much more balanced in the way they look at family versus work. But there are still people like me that just put it first, put work first, and said it's like being part of an athletic team. You know, if you're going to do something, do it really, really well. And that's how I always felt. I'm going to do it really, really well. And the reward is people around me would recognize that I contributed and they see something in the leadership, the ability to influence ideas, the ability to lead people to a better thing. And that's enough pay for me. It's like a drug. And it's lasted me until today. I'm 74 years old and I'm still, you know, as active and working as hard as I ever have. Now, I like to work on different things. Certain things make me more excited than the things that when I was 35. But yeah, I'm up early in the morning. I work out. I'm growing a venture firm that we started back in 2015. We're on our third fund and have about $1 billion under management. We're investing in young entrepreneurs in the tech world. And yeah, it's I wouldn't know it any other way. I just can't. You know, I have a lot of friends in their 70s that, you know, play around at golf and sit on the couch. And I just don't know how they do it.
Not you. Thank you for that. That's inside that answer and also a comment that you made. You are a curious individual that puts yourself into situations that are sometimes you have to understand and kind of climb in and get a deeper understanding of the landscape. Carnegie Mellon is an example. Being a venture capitalist is another. Your call to becoming a president, whether it's a president of a fraternity, the president of CEO of Oracle or whatever, you respond intuitively sometimes to the opportunity to learn. And now you're working with all these young entrepreneurs. Is there something from your past and your core values or from a mentor of your past that has given you this fire in the belly to always want to continue to improve and learn and grow?
I certainly did come from my growing up. So in my household, as I said, my father basically had one job for a design firm as an engineer. And over the 20 years before I went off to college or 18 years from off to college, life looked pretty much the same. Dad went to work. Dad came home. Dad studied. Mom, you know, cooked the meals and took care of us. And I had a great friend that was a next door neighbor and we'd spend time together. And that, I mean, life looked pretty much the same, you know, it's every day. I think it was when I left, certainly in college, that changed me. To be recognized as a leader of anything was the first time in my life. So leading my fraternity and then being asked to be part of the ranking men's honorary. I was elected president of my senior class in college. I said, okay, something's going on here that I don't understand, but I really enjoy it. I get a kick out of it because not only do you get a bit of an ego kick out of it, everybody does, everybody has an ego, but it's more, I feel like I actually have a talent to listen to people and respond and say, okay, let's go this direction. Let's look at the problem a different way. A woman named Liz Wiseman wrote a book after I left Oracle called The Multipliers. And she said, Oracle, before you came here, was a very competitive place, competitive externally and competitive internally. And she thought about having worked for me for 8 years, I saw a different way to manage businesses and manage people in you. And at first, she didn't know how to label it until she wrote the book. And she said, you know, a lot of people are diminishers. So you go in with an idea or go in for a meeting and your presentation or whatever. And the boss says, you know, geez, it's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Throw that away. Or they just go out of that meeting not feeling very good about themselves. And you always ask questions about, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And I felt like I concluded myself that it was a dumb idea to come with that presentation, or maybe the wrong time, but I concluded myself and I wanted to do better. I wanted to work harder to make it better next time. And I never knew that until she wrote the book. And so I think if I look at all of that, I point to one instance in my background of where things changed. It's when I decided to leave IBM. In those days, nobody really left IBM. IBM was a great place to be. Everybody was, they were great at training people, being part of their organization. Sales product organization was, in the neighborhoods you lived, I lived in Washington, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati. You were kind of in an IBM, community bedroom that, you go to parties and other people admired you to say, what's going on at IBM? You guys are so happy. So nobody left IBM. And I made the decision, influenced by the guy that hired me at IBM, who went to EDS to work for Ross Perot. And it really surprised me and surprised my wife that after several days of trying to decide through different methodologies, like putting little pieces of paper in a hat or considering secondary factors and all, we made the decision to leave the Midwest part of the country and move to Dallas, Texas. We had never been to Texas. And we looked at each other, and it was only after we made the decision. And we're just looking at each other and say, okay, I'm curious as to why. I thought you would say, let's stay with IBM. Do the conservative thing because I was on a fast track at IBM. And she says, well, I thought you would too. Yet we both voted to move to Dallas and go to EDS. Only after the decision, she divulged. She says, well, that's where EDS is headquarters, and I'm tired of moving the family around. So if we can be in one place, that's – and, of course, I said, well, I just skipped 10 years on the ladder because I wouldn't become – I wouldn't have this kind of responsibility for another 10 years at IBM that I'm getting at EDS. So we each had our own reason. It was very difficult, even though we're married to each other, to divulge what that reason was. But I realized after I did it and was happy I did it, and then ended up later at Booz Allen, I said, if I had stayed at IBM, many of my friends did, for 20 to 30 year careers, I would have been a very different and less happier guy. I kind of learned that you have to break the egg, you have to take the risk, whatever analog you want to use, and make the move with, kind of jumping over that chasm without knowing what's on the other side, and trusting yourself, trusting your abilities to come out of it, and you probably come out of it better.
That's right, but you can point back to that as kind of the seminal moment of
yeah.
leaving the safety of IBM. I felt like that from Procter & Gamble. And I love Procter & Gamble to this day, but it was probably the best thing to have done also. Let's talk about mentors. Let's have kind of the Ray Lane moment of thanksgiving or thankfulness for a couple of great mentors in your life that you think changed you forever. Who would those be?
Top of the list is Herb Jones. Herb is probably 80, coming up on 90 years of age, but he was a leader at IBM. He hired me at IBM. He was running the Pittsburgh office of IBM, and then I think the Charleston office of IBM. But he thought it was a good idea to visit the local university and recruit there, bring the IBM story to somewhere it hadn't been, and recruit directly from college and train people. Try to make it a very short story, but as I was being trained at IBM, he would be the only manager who would actually drive to where we were trained in Cincinnati, who would actually drive and check in on us and actually participate and listen to presentations, tear us apart, and then take us to lunch afterwards and tell us, you know, what we had done wrong, how we improve, and did it on a repetitive basis. And I just thought, you know, and here I am 23, 22, 25, I said, I want to be like this guy. He's tough. He explains. He's fair. And so I worked for him for a couple of years. I worked for him for about 8 months and then got drafted. Went through the Army for 2 years during the Vietnam era. And I came back to IBM and he was gone. He had been promoted somewhere else. He was on the West Coast running the whole California and Hawaii division. And he's the one that called me and he said, I'd like you to come to, I just left IBM. I'm going to EDS as president. He said, I'd like you to come and run a division of EDS. And I'm thinking, gee, EDS, who's EDS? And I'd heard the stories of Ross Perot and dropping Christmas presents over, you know, to Vietnam soldiers and, you know, what a patriot he was and all that. And I said, this is a massive, massive change for me. But because he had done so much and influenced me so much, I said, this is, you know, and then the whole story about with my wife making that decision, my wife was always somewhat charmed by Herb. And I knew that was part of her decision too, is that let's go work for Herb again. And and so I think he, you know, because I was so young and trained and watched him, observed him, it's not so much training and instruction and here's how you do it. It's really observation. And I think I became more like him in terms of, you know, being very clear, very transparent, very direct. People tell me all the time, I know what's in your head because you just tell me. It just comes from the heart, and sometimes it's dangerous, but it just feels like you're telling me the truth all the time. And being transparent, I think, is a huge weapon in business. It allows people to respond in kind. And so I think Herb is number one. Number two would be a guy named Eric Zausner. Eric Zausner was the managing partner of the commercial part of Booz Allen. I was one of six practice leaders that worked directly for him. Loved this guy's style. This was a no bullshit. Come in my office. He lights up a cigar. He basically said just no, you know, and most consultants are not that way. They don't cut to the quick. They don't solve problems. They don't, you know, they're very process oriented. And he was not that. He was all about making Booz Allen a better place, changing the business, putting the right leadership in place. So he taught me a lot. And Booz Allen, I can't thank Booz Allen enough. I never got the chance to get an MBA or a master's degree, but I did at Booz Allen by doing technology and strategy assignments for clients over 12 years, building the largest practice Booz Allen had in information technology. All of those things gave me an MBA and a lot of leadership attributes that I still use today. So Eric would probably be number two. The third and fourth, I've not actually thought about this question before you asked it, but I'd have to say, I put guys like, there's three guys that I'd put in a dead tie that were all mentors in different ways. Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, and Ross Perot. I learned a lot from each of them because they are self-made people. They are entrepreneurs who are able to, and I think all three of them were very similar in that they weren't just simply technology visionaries. They were technology commercializers. They knew how to take an idea, even if it wasn't theirs. You know, SQL was not Larry's idea. It was IBM's idea. But he and some compatriots on a project he was working on understood the whole idea of SQL and what it would do for business programming and applications in enterprises and basically started using SQL and building a company called Relational Technology, Inc., which turned out to be Oracle. And so Steve Jobs, I think, is the same. He has invented a lot of technology, but he also took technology that was invented. The iPod really, you know, there were other iPods out there already before Apple came along, the Diamond Rio. But he knew how to commercialize it. And Ross Perot, the same thing. So I think those three contributed much the same thing to my life, and that is, it's just not an important technology unless you can scale it and commercialize it. People have to pay for it, recognize it. It's like a tree in the forest, and you know, if it falls and nobody hears it, and there's a lot of technology out there that will never see the light of day. So you have to know how to commercialize and scale technology. And I think the three of them, I watched the three of them operate and I learned a lot from them.
That is the three greatest mentors I've ever heard of that are tied for third place. Steve, Larry, and Ross Perot. Mm-hmm. So
I want to also say it because, and try not to be too conventional about this, because a lot of people say, well, my father was my mentor. I don't say that because he, of course, is. He That's made right. me what I am. I am him. I look like him. I have the same name. I work as hard as he worked. I accepted the appointment of the board of Carnegie Mellon because of him. He died when I was 18 of cancer, and I wish he could have met my first wife, met his grandchildren, seen that I'd become chairman of his university. You know, those are kinds of things that drive me. So my dad was a very, very important part of my life, but for only 18 years.
Well, here's to your dad first, and then Herb, Eric, Steve, Larry, and Ross. And I could spend all day talking with you, but I'm trying to manage to, in respect to your time. But I've got to ask you about Ross Perot. And in doing so, thank you for your service in Vietnam, by the way. Mm-hmm. Ross, I grew up in Dallas, and Ross was a great patriot. I would love for you to just give a little bit of commentary on how a leader like Ross Perot was able to instill patriotism in employees in EDS, even if they didn't feel patriotic.
Well, the early days of EDS, they were all patriotic because all the recruiting at EDS was done out of the military. So right. Ross, it was Ross's idea. It was a great idea. He, you know, in the late 60s and 70s had to scale EDS. The opportunity was very, very large. He saw an opportunity after leaving IBM to basically manage the IT facilities for his customers, rather than mm-hmm. what IBM did. IBM would sell you the equipment and then they would have to manage it and hire the people, and they could never hire as good of people as EDS could train. So the pipeline of people that came to EDS all came from the military. So to operate the computers, you know, there's nothing better than having ex-military and the discipline they carried.
Right.
And then Ross was brilliant. I mean, after Vietnam wound down and he couldn't depend on the military as a source for people, he had to turn to colleges. And I remember when I joined EDS, it was easy in terms of in the interview with Ross. You know, I asked Herb how it went. I spent 2 hours with Ross. I felt like he was stale. He was looking right through my eyes to the back of my head every moment of that interview. He had steel gray eyes. He listens intently, and you just talk yourself to death. And maybe, you know. So he said, I remember one question where he asked me, so why do you think you're as good as Herb tells me you are? And I spent 10 minutes and tell him why I'm good. I think I'm so good. And he said, well, now that you've told me why IBM is so good, because I haven't heard a single thing about why you would be good outside of IBM. You've told me why you're good inside IBM. After we went through 2 hours of grueling interview, I asked Herb how it went. And he said, cut your mustache, get Thai shoes, and be here next week. I said, huh? So we had a strict policy. Yep, strict policy of Thai shoes, you know, suits, white shirts, no facial hair. When Vietnam was wearing down and we had needed people, Ross was the first one that says, those policies are dead. The policy I created is dead. Color shirts, facial hair. You remember the 70s, right?
Oh, yes.
How could you go to a college campus or recruit people in the EDS if you were saying you have to wear a white shirt and a tie and have no facial hair? And so so he basically changed that policy and we went forward. But so Ross is somebody who's a great thinker, a great salesman. I mean, he can sell ice cubes to Eskimos, very influential. And what I learned from him is I love going into a room where everybody thinks we're going to make a decision to go left, and I think we should go right. There's nothing that makes me happier than to spend 2 hours building the argument to go right. And at the end, everybody says, let's go right. Ross could do that better than anybody. I was there when he bailed the two employees out of Iran. All that was going on right next to my office. I never even knew it. We'd see the lights on all night in the offices, and you know there were, but yeah. So the patriotism. He never said a word about it. It was never you must act this way. You must. You know, you must salute the flag. You must. It was just simply he walked the talk. He was it. You drive into EDS's headquarters on Forest Lane, which is obviously not there anymore. There you see 50 flags. You know, as you drive up you knew you were in a very patriotic organization. So
that's right. God bless him. He's still one of my heroes.
I'd like to see a lot of that come back.
So, oh, I would too. Mm-hmm. I would too. Mm-hmm. I probably need to have you on another show to talk about American philosophy and all that. But I've got just a couple more questions for you today.
Okay.
We've been studying fear on this show for the last couple of years, and And I think every time we have an individual like you on the show who has done a lot in their life and worked for a lot of people and had some great mentors like you, we really need to get down to talking about how have you managed your relationship with fear over the course of your career. And as you talk to young entrepreneurs today and invest as a venture capitalist, what sort of advice are you giving them relative to how to manage risk and but how to manage fear as a your relationship inside your professional career separately from your personal career? So we'd love to get your insight on that.
Well, assuming you're talking about fear of making the wrong decision or going the wrong pathway or anything.
Yes.
It drives me. I mean, I'll just be really honest with you. It drives me on everything I do in business, certainly. I don't know about personal, but in business, even today, where I feel like I'm certainly always the oldest guy in the room. I'm supposedly the most experienced or wisest guy in the room, but I still worry about, did I make the right decision? Am I saying the right things? So it lives within me. It lives, and I think it is a driver of success. And I may be totally wrong about this, but I think it's a driver of youth. I think I have friends who ride the couch all day and play golf, and I see them getting old. But fear of, making the right decision, of picking the right people, trying to hire a new partner in our business today, trying to make the right decision about that particular person. All of that, constantly thinking about it. I just went to Italy for a week with my wife, and I'm constantly walking the sidewalk thinking about, is this the right direction? Is this the right, and she knows me so well, she knows how to get my attention. She knows when I'm not thinking, I'm the moment, I'm not with her. So she can straighten me out. But yeah, it drives me. Fear drives me.
Excellent. Last question for you is about success. And we talk about success all the time here. And I'm wondering if, in your estimation, you could provide what you think is a definition for success, but advice on how people can move from success to significance, regardless of their age and stage in life.
I think I answered that question by preempting it in the first conversation we had. And as I said, no matter, what your title is or what your wealth status is, and treating people and having people recognize that you are the person that I knew 10 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, you're the same person. It comes from within. To me, is success in life. It's, I don't want to be, I'm sure there are people who look back and say, well, he fired me and I don't really care for him that much. And I don't know. I think I'm fair. I want to make sure that everybody understands a decision that I make and why I made that decision and what the impact, and that their life might be better with this decision being made. And then I have, again, lots of friends that I just this morning on a elliptical for an hour talking to that neighbor friend that I grew up with. He's in Florida now. Yep. He's a doctor. And we talk once a week, maybe more. We go hunting and fishing together. And he's known me since I was 8 years old. And then Saturday night, I'll have a lot of my fraternity brothers here. and we'll laugh about the same stories we've told, 200 times. We'll do the same thing, the same routine over and over again. And I think they know, and I hear them say it every once, and they may say it to somebody else who relays to me, says, "You should know that so-and-so said this about you." And he says, "He hasn't changed. I know he's done this thing." And some of them don't even understand the world I went into. You grew up in Pittsburgh, you go in the steel business, you go into, and I left that world because of the decision I made to go to IBM. IBM just took me on a totally different vector. And so a lot of my friends, I went to college with and said, I don't really understand that career you took. I'm not sure, but I know you did something and I know you did a lot. And I know, but you're the same guy to me. You're the same, treat me the same. And I think that's the key, is you have to treat people, all people, with respect, dignity, but present yourself as fair and balanced and say, if I have to make a tough decision, I'm going to make sure that the people that feel they're on the wrong end of that decision understand why the decision was made. But it's a decision. And if I'm wrong, I will admit it. I'll admit that I'm wrong and say, okay, I'm wrong. I was wrong. Let's change the decision.
Ray, just summing up our conversation today, you are the amalgamation of your dad, of Herb, Eric, Steve, Larry, Ross, best friend from that you met when you were 8 years old, all your experiences. And I just love what you said about being transparent is a huge weapon. Amen to that. And that when it comes down to being significant, maybe if we were all a little bit more like Herb Jones, who's tough, fair, clear, direct, comes from the heart, that's how we can perhaps move from success to significance, is to be like your very mentors that shaped you. And I just thank you so much for sharing this. I'd love to interview you and talk with you once a year to get the Ray Lane update on the world at large.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. I'd love to do that. It's a lot of fun. I'd rather talk about something other than myself. I love your question about achieving significance. And I do think it is, is it significance in your own mind, or is it significance in the community that will be there when it's all over? And I just love to think that when the party's over, my family will be standing around, and there will be a lot of friends that say he was a very close friend and treated me as such.
That's great. Thanks again, Ray. We appreciate you. And thanks again to Philippe for introducing us. And we look forward to our annual talk with Ray Lane. Have a great weekend. Have a great time with your friends, and continued great success. And it sounds like to me that brain is going to keep, the wheels are going to keep turning. Even if you're in Rome or Florence or wherever in Italy, keep thinking and keep moving. So we appreciate that. And folks, as we always say here, likewise. And as we always say here, and as Ray exemplified today, you can move your life from ordinary to extraordinary as well, and maybe be like his mentor, Herb Jones, who was tough, fair, clear, direct, and he came from right from the heart. Thanks again, Ray. It was an honor to have you on Legends.
Thank you, Rick.
You bet. And we thank our sponsors of today's show, Edward Jones Financial Advisors, for their great long-term support of this network. Until next time, have a great week.